Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the slow rollout of the COVID vaccine. The images of the first healthcare workers receiving coronavirus vaccines in mid-December was the good news story we all needed at the end of a hard year. But as we move into 2021, a more sobering reality emerged. Distributing and administering the shots has proven to be a complicated and confusing process, leading to delays. My guest today, Elizabeth Rosenthal, saw it all coming. She's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and author of An American Sickness: How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. So, Elizabeth, the vaccine is being rolled out. People are getting excited about it. But things are off to a slower start than we initially thought. Tell us some of the reasons for that.
Yeah, you know, Operation Warp Speed was amazing in how quickly it developed a vaccine. But as so often happens, the chain is only as strong as the weakest link in getting it into people's arms. And we've done much less thought and planning about how to get that vaccine once it's developed into vials, shipped to states, how states will dispense it to different counties and hospitals. So there's this long chain of decisions that stands between, you know, Moderna or Pfizer in their plant and getting a vaccine into your arm or my arm. And that's been total chaos. And that's where I think we failed in a way that was kind of predictable because we don't have a system for doing public health at this point in this country. So we had this kind of trickle-down theory of distribution where the vaccines once made, you know, the companies would sometimes use FedEx, sometimes their own distribution system. The feds would say each state gets X many vaccines, supposedly based on population, but they didn't get as many as promised. Then the states would decide how to allocate those vaccines, each according to its own sometimes not very transparent decision-making process. And so what we've ended up with, I think, is tragic in that we've only gotten, you know, a small percentage of the vaccines that are out there into people's arms. And we, in many places, have done it in a very inequitable way. We haven't used them wisely. So just as a little example, a few little examples we hear about at Kaiser Health News, one nursing home that is apparently pretty well connected vaccinates every resident in week one. Another nursing home, you know, 10 miles away, still has no idea when it's going to get vaccine for its residents. At some hospitals, the decision was made, we're going to vaccinate the entire hospital staff before any of our older patients who are much more vulnerable. So, for example, a psychiatrist who has never been in the hospital during the COVID pandemic and is seeing everyone on Zoom will get vaccinated, but a high-risk 75-year-old with diabetes and heart disease won't get that vaccine. So, as with everything in our medical system, it's about your microenvironment. And unfortunately, does that function equitably or does that function according to self-interest or does that function according to political ties? Craziness, right?
And that's where I want to go back to the distribution to the states themselves. Has that been done equitably, or has that depended on politics?
Well, here, we're on radio, so I can't just shrug, but I'm giving a big shrug because the official line was we are distributing it according to population, which you could say makes some sense. That sounds equitable. But actually, what states received was far less than they were promised initially. So I think what we don't know is, did some states, for political reasons or for political tie reasons, get less than promised? And did others who are better well-connected get the full amount they were promised? Because if you got the full amount when you were promised, when you were promised them, that makes it at least easier to do the logistics. It's still not simple. It's still hard, really hard, because, as I said, there's all of these chains of command. You know, I thought it was amusing that President Trump said, well, it's going to work great because we have a four-star general who does logistics running this. And that is a nice idea. But when General Perna is doing logistics in the Army, he controls the supply chain. Here, he doesn't. You know, he throws it out into this messy, disorganized, hyper-local healthcare non-system that does what it will, with little accountability, frankly, in many places to the patients it's supposed to serve.
So we've already heard about one pharmacist who refused or destroyed 500 doses because he thought that the vaccine was somehow dangerous.
We did hear about it. It was a pharmacist, and I believe he's now being prosecuted for that. And that's obviously a very extreme case. I haven't heard of a lot of vaccine being destroyed. That's the end, one end of the spectrum. There's also, like, a hospital gets it. Well, is the hospital CEO getting it? We hear about, for example, politicians getting it. Well, maybe that makes sense because they're out in the public, but then their spouses are getting it. Does that really make sense? They're not out in the public. So I think what you see in some other countries who either have a national health system or are just more organized in terms of public health is a very clear-cut decision tree of what order we're going to vaccinate people and when. And, you know, a lot of people will say to me, yes, in Israel, they've now vaccinated something like 10 or 20% of the population. Everyone over 65 got it first. People will say, well, that's a small country. And it's really not about national size. It's about national organization and having a national strategy and a national plan that's clear cut, that you have the buy-in and the power to execute down to the level of, you know, in a CVS, putting a shot in an arm. And we just have nothing like that in this country. You know, when it gets to CVS, CVS is or Walgreens or my local hospital, those are all private independent institutions, and the CDC can't tell them what to do. They will each make their own plan. So I am quite worried going forward. You know, we're talking about kind of hiccups in the first stage of this vaccine distribution, which in many ways should be the simplest because it's going to hospitals who have places to give vaccines, who have skilled personnel, and it's so messed up even at hospitals. What's going to happen when it's out in the general public? And I'll give you two little examples of why this makes me so worried. One is, you know, we're hearing first from some primary care doctors out there in the community who are treating a lot of COVID because they are not connected with a hospital. They're not on a hospital staff. They have no idea when they're going to get vaccinated, even though many of them are at high risk. And even though we know many of the family practice and primary care doctors in this country are on the older end of the age spectrum, so at risk. Another little example of that is people who are older but not living in an assisted living or nursing home environment. So we got a note from a couple, 85 and 89, who are living independently by themselves at home. They have no idea how they can get a vaccine because they're not plugged into a system. Now, what many states and counties are doing here in DC, where I live, is they've announced they're going to have a website where when it's your turn, if you know when it's your turn, you can sign up for an appointment. But that, to me, is also crazy because it turns, you know, we heard in Florida where it's being done that way in many places, you know, you people get up at 5 a.m. and start clicking on a website like you're trying to get a, you know, a concert ticket. This is no way to run a national vaccine rollout. If I don't get my Rolling Stones ticket, so be it. But if I don't get my COVID shot, because I'm not a good morning person, I don't get up at 4 a.m. to start, you know, clicking over and over again on a website, that's not right.
I, too, live in D.C. I received a notification asking me to enter my birth date, my health, and then when I finished, it said to me, you are not yet eligible to receive that injection. We will let you know when the time comes. Yet the other day, I read in the newspapers that everyone 75 and older will be eligible to receive the vaccine as of January 11th. You know, who knows what is going to happen?
Yeah, and I think I heard that too, and I'm kind of half, you know, celebrating and half dreading that day. I mean, D.C. has been more organized than most places, and at least telling you that, you know, on this day, we're going to start rolling out vaccine to the general public. But what will happen on that day? Are you going to be lining up at Walgreens?
Yes, yeah.
Are you going to have an appointment? You know, we know that, you know, you've been into pharmacies. They're great for certain things, but they're not great for mass vaccination programs. They don't have the space, really. And this is a vaccine that works well, but it's what physicians call immunogenic. So people have to wait for 15 minutes or half an hour after they get it. So, you know, we have in our mind the flu shot, which is, you know, get it in your arm and then walk out. This is a much more complicated vaccine in that it comes frozen. It has to be defrozen for like an hour or two, then it has to be mixed and then injected. And it's really a lot to expect that we're going to have mass vaccination at pharmacies. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I am. But why not try something like mobilizing the National Guard to do mass vaccination at certain sites around our city, D.C., or elsewhere? I haven't heard that proposed yet, but, you know, maybe the new administration will suggest things like that. Now we've left it to private systems, and private systems are not good at doing the public's bidding.
Now, you mentioned the vaccine that has to be kept frozen and is then used. There is, of course, the Moderna vaccine that does not have to be frozen. The question is the patient going to have any idea and or say into which vaccine he or she receives?
No, I think you're going to get whatever your local environment has. And I don't, genuinely, from what I know as a journalist and as a somewhat lapsed physician, since I haven't practiced for, you know, 25 years now, I really don't think it matters which one you get. But when we say the Moderna vaccine doesn't have to be frozen, it doesn't have to be kept ultra cold like the Pfizer vaccine. It does have to be, I think, frozen and then defrosted. So it involves rather elaborate preparation by a pharmacist or a healthcare professional in order to get it ready for injection. So it's a lot to ask of pharmacies. There are a couple of vaccines coming down the pike that may well get emergency use approval in the near future that will be easier to use, but we don't know enough about them yet to say for sure.
Of course, the other issue that has now become a larger issue is the fact of variants. And do we absolutely know for certain that the vaccines that have been created will treat the variant that is now in this country.
Yeah, I think I'm not a vaccinologist, but I speak to them, and I think they feel pretty confident that these vaccines will be effective against the variant. And I will get my vaccine when, as I said in my op-ed in the New York Times, when it's my turn, if I can figure out when that is and where to get it. But I think the evidence is that it will. And just people should remember that the flu vaccine, which we get now many of us religiously every year, is not 100% effective. It's not very effective many years, but this is a game of mass numbers. So even if a vaccine is only 40% effective, that cuts down on transmission. And the theory among many vaccinologists is, for example, the chickenpox vaccine. It is not 100% effective against preventing chickenpox. But if you get chickenpox, you get a milder case. So that's important too. Now, there's a lot we don't know about these new vaccines because they were developed so quickly, about, you know, what their true exact efficacy will be. But, you know, they're certainly a very important tool in our quest to end this pandemic, which should be always accompanied by, as it is usually here in DC, mask wearing, social distancing, and hand washing until we really have this under control. So the idea that you'll get your shot and hop on a plane is misguided.
As you have written, Donald Trump could have invoked the Defense Production Act. How would that have made a difference, not only in the production itself, but in the rollout to the various states?
This is where a logistics person would, a really good logistics person would come in handy, in the sense of the roadblocks in testing, in mask making, in now in vaccine distribution are often these little weak links that you don't think of. Remember with testing, it was, oh, there weren't enough swabs, you know. Okay, so you get someone to make, you know, you commandeer swab production in this country and say you're only making it for tests. Now we hear that one of the limiting steps may be little glass vials, right? Or refrigeration or ultra cold refrigeration. You say to companies that know how to do that, okay, I don't care what else you're doing, you're going to do this right now. Also with distribution, you know, we know a lot of the vaccine now is being distributed via FedEx or UPS or I'm not sure about USPS. Are those vaccine distributions competing with the standing desk I just ordered on FedEx? You know, I think you commandeer the systems we have if you use the Defense Production Act. And I don't know which of the links is the biggest bottleneck now, but by invoking that, you kind of open up those bottlenecks. And that was how it was used in World War II, right? Or its predecessor, where we need to make plane parts. Well, we're behind on that, but toy makers actually have the equipment that could make them. So stop making toys, make plane parts. So if you have a good central command that invoking that act can control the distribution system, there are presumably lots of bottlenecks you could avoid.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Elizabeth Rosenthal.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She's the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business, and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, what about the resistors? What kind of a difference will they or could they make in terms of providing that protection that all of us are hoping for?
Well, I think it depends how many of them there are. I mean, obviously, if a resistor is a pharmacist trashing 500 doses, that's a terrible thing. As long as they are in the minority and most of us get shots, I think it's their loss because they won't be protected. But you don't need every person in a population to get a vaccine in order to get that herd immunity. You just need, the more you get, the better. But, my attitude towards resistors, as long as there won't be too many, and we've seen a massive shift from hesitance to now that they've seen, you know, doctors and all the Congress getting the shot, you know, not, I don't want it, but when can I get mine? Even people who said this was a hoax, I note, are now like, when do I get mine?
However, here's what I'm worried about. We're now seeing a resurgence of measles in this country because of resistors.
Yes, I think I'm not saying we should encourage resistors. I think we need to, you know, push hard to get them to take shots. Companies can say, you need to get shots if you want to come back to the office. Schools, presumably, as with measles, will say, you know, kids should be vaccinated. This will be a required inoculation for school attendance. Colleges can do that. Some people may find, you know, medical or religious excuses, but those will be a small number of people. And measles is incredibly contagious. This is contagious, but not as contagious, you know, more contagious than SARS was, less contagious than measles.
Interesting.
You know, yes, I think we should go full steam ahead with vaccination. I think the more people who get it, the more people will want it because, you know, and measles in some way is a different thing in that people don't remember what it was like to have measles on the whole. People remember COVID. They know COVID. I'm a New Yorker. Everyone in New York was traumatized by COVID. So they all want the vaccine. I suspect what's going on now in LA, you know, it's all across the country now. So I think, you know, you may never get through to the people who think this is all a hoax, even as they're being put on a ventilator. And we have heard of people like that. But I think you're going to find the resistance to this waning and the problem being we can't get this stuff out fast enough as we should. We shouldn't have to wait, you know, till next year to get the country vaccinated.
So that's the question. How, as the system currently exists, how are people going to know when it's their turn to get the vaccine?
Well, I'm hopeful that the new administration will develop a more centralized plan for vaccine distribution. One simple thing is, you know, everyone in this country over 65 is enrolled in Medicare, so they know where those people are, how to reach them. There could be a mass notification to Medicare eligible recipients. We will arrange for your vaccine at this day, at this time. I mean, my brother, who lives in Belgium, has gotten a little card, who is not yet Medicare eligible, saying, we will let you know where and when to come for your vaccine. It will likely be sometime in March. You know, even that would help. It would help me tremendously knowing that, okay, on April 15th, if I have to wait that long, I'm going to get a shot. And, you know, 3 weeks later, I'll get my second shot. And, you know, then it's easier to to kind of, you know, do what I have to do for the next 3 months of isolation and, you know, not seeing my kids if I know there's an end in sight. So now there's this kind of theoretical end of the tunnel, but we don't know how far away that is. So I really hope the new administration comes in with a more concrete plan that will at least give people some sense of this is your group, this is when you'll get it. You know, I would like to see it not be solely through commercial pharmacies, frankly, partly because, you know, I'm of an age where I should have gotten the shingles vaccine by now. Every time I go into the pharmacy, they're out of stock. Like, you know, I think we need a more centralized, concerted approach. And the government does have the power to do that. The Trump administration did have the power to do that, but chose not to, you know, chose to pass off the responsibility to the states.
So now, because of the lack of number of doses, there's lots of talk about administering half doses, even though the FDA has said this is not a good idea. It does not give the kind of immunity that two full doses will indeed do. So what are doctors and pharmacies to do? Are they to follow FDA guidelines? Do they make their own choices? What do they do?
Well, I think for now, I would be surprised if anyone didn't do the full prescribed, you know, two doses at full strength. I mean, I think the reason people feel emboldened to try this is with many vaccines, we do find that, you know, they're designed and trialed as a three-shot vaccine, but we discover after a few years of use, actually the immunity is pretty good after just two shots, so you don't really need that third shot. And we may discover that with this ultimately, but we know it works in this, with these first two vaccines in this, with a full dose, two doses. That's how it's been studied. That's what the trials used, and they were very short trials. So, you know, I think to deviate from that, and the infectious disease people I know say it's just a terrible idea to deviate with that. And it's a bad excuse for being disorganized, you know. Because we're disorganized, we're going to try something risky. No, the answer is get organized, not try risky, unproven tactics.
So you've said that you would prefer not to receive your injection in a pharmacy. Are doctors going to be overwhelmed with requests that they administer the vaccine? And if they're in hospitals, doesn't that give an even greater risk to a patient who's walking into a hospital for a vaccine than it would walking into a CVS?
Well, I think, you know, it's not so much the environment I worry about, is that I don't think, you know, CVS, the pharmacies are there, yes, to do our prescriptions and give us our flu shots, but they're also doing all sorts of other things. It is not their primary job in this country, you know. They're selling toilet paper and hand sanitizer, and the pharmacist is one or two people who already has a full-time job, right? It's not like there's a lot of, they're not sitting there most of the day waiting for a vaccine, so yeah. They have other things to do. So I'm not even sure that doctor's offices, yeah, if you have a relatively small patient panel, maybe your nurse could do it there. I feel much more comfortable walking into a hospital now than I do to my pharmacy, because hospitals have elaborate security procedures going in. I've been going to Johns Hopkins for some treatment. You know, there's COVID screening as you go in the door. You answer questions. It's really controlled. And their COVID testing is out in a parking lot. Hospitals have or have the ability to set up a tent clinic or something like that. But in many ways, You know, my ideal would be more like those quick start hospitals that the National Guard set up in cities when COVID was raging in New York and elsewhere. Something like that, where we could just do mass vaccinations. Now, that requires government involvement, right? It's not a outsourcing to the private sector. But in many ways, I think that's the appropriate venue. The problem right now is we've so hollowed out our public health sector in this country that they should be the ones directing that in each city. But they're often, you know, a handful of people who also right now have full-time jobs and are scrambling with the pandemic.
And President-elect Joe Biden has said, we can vaccinate 100 million people in the first 100 days in office. Considering the failure thus far, when 20 million doses were promised by the end of the year and only 2 million have been delivered, do you think he can make good on that promise?
Well, I think the question is going to be, and you know, this, as we've all seen, this has been a very messy handoff between administrations.
Yes.
How much of the distribution system that the Trump administration set up is kind of hardwired, so it's really hard to change? You know, are there contracts with pharmacies that we can't undo? Can you turn this into a more national strategy using the military? Or using, you know, National Guard, or using the Defense Production Act. I think if he can access those things, and if the current kind of trickle-down procedure for vaccine distribution isn't hardwired, that can be changed pretty quickly. So I am hopeful. This is not rocket science. In many ways, we've done scientifically the really hard part, which is coming up with a vaccine.
Sure.
You know, now we just need to figure out a way to get it out there and get it into people's arms. And I don't want to minimize the amount of physical planning that takes or the amount of personnel it takes, but it's all doable. It's not, you know, it's not rocket science.
I wonder how much of what has happened, the disappointment, the long lines, the low numbers of vaccine thus far distributed, are because of the way our healthcare system has been set up generally? And is there a basic need for change with that itself?
Well, I think the COVID pandemic has generally shown that our healthcare system, which is highly privatized, very profit-driven, very fragmented, is terrible at these kind of big public, very basic public health interventions. So I think it is kind of a condemnation of the way we run healthcare, in that, you know, when COVID first started, people would say, well, would ask me, how come these hospitals don't have more ventilators? And I'm like, because they're basically, you know, businesses, and why would you keep 100 ventilators in the basement that you hoped you didn't want to use? It's why I wrote my book about this, that, you know, I think we've let business take over our healthcare and profit be the driving force. Now, that doesn't mean we have to go to a national healthcare system. You know, I'm a journalist, so I'm kind of agnostic about which solution we choose, but it can't be the one we have now. For example, you know, the countries that have been very efficient at vaccine distribution, Israel is a national health system, so they have everyone in a database who they can reach right away, organize into a vaccine administration campaign. Germany is not a national health system, but there is a national health, I mean, there are multiple insurers, but there is a national health plan where, you know, there is everyone in a database. They may have different insurers, but there's a national infrastructure that allows them to do these kind of public health things. And we could choose that route as well. They also, by the way, control, my obsession, they have price setting for different procedures. So you can have a lot of insurers, but you can't just charge whatever you want.
That's another question. Are people going to eventually have to pay for this vaccine, or is it going to be distributed free of charge, whether it's at your doctor's office or a hospital or the CVS?
Well, we've essentially all paid with our tax dollars in a huge way for the development of these vaccines. The Operation Warp Speed gave billions of dollars to a number of companies to develop vaccine. And the promise has been that it will be free to customers, to patients. I think the question is, what does free mean in our system? Does it mean you won't have to pay, but your insurer will pay? I think not. I think it will be free, but in the sense of the vaccine itself. But remember, you will be going into an office or a pharmacy, so there may well be an office visit charge, which may not be free, right? We've seen this all the time on our the Bill of the Month series that we at KHN do with NPR. It's free. The shot was free, but the doctor charges $350. So, we'll be watching, and I'm sure there will be abuses. If people find they're being charged a lot or being charged, they can write to us a Bill of the Month, and we'll look into it. We're watching.
Finally, Elizabeth, people continue to die every day, every minute, practically. You've got this line showing the number of patients not only sick but dying going straight up. How important is it that a huge number of people get vaccinated quickly? And what does quickly mean?
Well, I think, yes, we are number one in the number of deaths, and it's tragic. And that early on in the pandemic, my mother was one of those deaths.
So I'm so sorry.
I feel this very personally.
I'm so sorry.
In her case, it was very early, so we didn't know very much about how to prevent COVID. So I don't blame anyone for that. Now people should not be dying this way at this rate. Now we know better. January, 10 months later, this is a preventable tragedy. Yes, getting the vaccine out as quickly as we can is really important to leveling off the illness and deaths. But equally important is people aren't wearing masks still. People aren't social distancing still. I think we Americans we tend to like these kind of, and this is a bad pun now, like one-shot solutions. Oh, I'm going to get a shot and then it will go away. No, even when every tool we use will help end this terrible pandemic, which, as we know from looking at other countries where there have been hundreds, not hundreds of thousands of deaths, didn't have to be. And so, the quicker we can get out the vaccine and into people's arms, that's great. But equally, and perhaps even more important for the next month or two, because the numbers of vaccines won't be big enough, is just put on a mask, just social distance. It's really not hard. When people tell me it's uncomfortable, I'm like, I worked as a physician, Surgeons wear masks for 12 hours a day.
Of course.
It's really not a big deal. And we know it works. We know it works with the old variant, the newer, more infectious variant. It is just boggles my mind why people are resistant to something so very simple, which as we wait for the vaccine to start making a dent, and it will, we can make a dent with much simpler.
Of course. Elizabeth, how old was your mother?
She was 96, and she was in an assisted living community in New York. And COVID, I think, got into that community before we knew it was even around.
Wow.
And, you know, she was, she had no pre-existing conditions. We used to joke she was the healthiest person in our family. But she didn't suffer, but she did succumb. And, you know, her death, I'm not sure could have been prevented. She got wonderful care where she was. It was terrible that we couldn't see her for the last 2 months of her life that included her 96th birthday. That will be a forever sorrow for me.
Indeed.
But I'm not angry about that the way I am angry about the deaths now, because the deaths now did not have to happen. The deaths then, we didn't know enough to really prevent them. Now we do.
Elizabeth, again, my deepest sympathy to the loss of your mother. Thank you so much for being with us and providing the kind of information that we all really need to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She's the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business, and How You Can Take It Back. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Ben Privett. Thanks for listening, all, and please remember to continue wearing those masks and keep a social distance. I'm Diane Rehm.